that I concluded on yesterday in the question department that I'd like to go ahead and do so that I don't run out of time. Before that, we have one very important thing to do. Is Tanner George here? Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday, dear Tanner. Happy birthday to you. Now, when I'm in the nursing home and you come visit me, you can get even. Tanner's one of the good guys, but we got a bunch of them here today, so that's great. Okay. I was talking about membership. One of the questions that we had was, there's really two questions here in this. One of them was membership roles, and one question had to do with should we know who is on the rolls in our various congregations? In other words, should we know who the members of a congregation are? And then related to that will be comments about letters of recommendation and so forth and the transfer of membership. And I thought those were two very practical questions that do come up. And I'll show you my thoughts on the first one, and then I'll pause and you can add to that. I think it is very important for a congregation and the leadership of that congregation, but not just the leadership of that congregation, to know who is affiliated as a member of that congregation. And it might or might not surprise you to know that there are numerous congregations that some of us go to that, shall we say, aren't sure who is and who isn't. They have people that have attended for 20 years, but they can't ever remember them ever officially becoming a member, and it makes it very, very difficult. I will, in terms of scriptures that I would place with that, I used 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 12 as one of them. I didn't put these on the PowerPoint. I'm just going to turn and read that. In 1 Thessalonians chapter 5, verse 12, Paul says, "And we beseech you, brethren, to know them which labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you." And I take that phrase to know those who are among you, meaning know who is part of your congregation. Because here at Thessalonica, they didn't know all Christians. They didn't know everyone that was part of the church universal, but they were to know those that were among them. And I think that's the local congregation. Obviously, they were to know those who were over them in the Lord. In other words, know who your leaders are in that congregation. I don't know that that's quite as difficult, but I think very much that is a local congregational passage. And I would also put with that a couple of others while I'm on it. I mentioned this verse earlier, Hebrews 13 and 17. I mentioned this in terms of being a joy to our leaders, not a grief. But when I look at Hebrews 13 and 17, it says, "Obey them that have the rule over you and submit yourselves, for they watch for your souls." That's an admonition, as I understand it, to our eldership, having a responsibility to watch for our souls. Well, how can we ask them to be responsible for us if they don't know what souls they are to be responsible for? So to me, just common sense says that an elder has the right, not only has the right, he has the responsibility of knowing who is in his flock and who isn't in his flock. And not that it's needed, but I also look at 1 Peter chapter 5, verse 2 in that context also. Here it's talking about some of the responsibilities of our leaders. "Feed the flock which is among you, taking the oversight thereof." They have a responsibility for feeding and overseeing the flock that is among them, which to me infers they're going to need to know who is in that flock. Now, many of us, maybe all of us, have seen cases where someone, for emotional reasons, I usually see this when they've been raised in a rural congregation that's rather small, and they've moved to the cities, and it seems like to them it's almost pulling the rug out from under that small congregation to move their membership. There's something about if they're the 10th member, they don't want it to go down to 9. But if you're have moved on a permanent or an extended basis, we're to be under the guidance of leaders. And even if they thought they were going to go back to the country when they retired, well, okay, then you can move your membership back to the country. But I think those passages, and I imagine there are others, to me pretty clearly say that we need to align ourselves with a faithful group. And having said that, there are a few times, like going to college or maybe in the military, where you don't have that option. The military, I understand a little better. When you join the military, despite what the recruiting officer says, you don't know where you're going to end up. And you may not. Now, in college, I've had young people come to me and say, well, there's just not a faithful congregation where I'm going to college. What should I do? Well, I often say, well, let's do the best you can, but that's usually not what I'm thinking. What I'm often thinking is you should have checked into that before you chose that college. So if I could soapbox for just a minute, when you're choosing a college or something like that, or adults, when you're choosing a job, don't simply look at the school system and don't simply look at what they major in. Also look at your options to meet with a faithful congregation, because you can find a school that has your particular major in it that will allow you to be somewhat near a faithful congregation. If you want to go to a good law or medical school, Indiana University is where you want to go. If you want to do something else, some people have gone to Kansas University, but, well, just be prayerful in your choices. That's all I'll say. Okay. I hope you got my point. Does anybody want to have a comment or maybe a scripture that drives home the need to be affiliated with a local congregation even more or equally? Keith?
One consideration is 1 Corinthians chapter 12 and the comparison of the church to the body of Christ. We have a connection that we need to have with one another. We have a connection that demands a certain continuity. If my hand becomes detached from my body, it's not very functional. Yeah. We need to be part of a working body, and it's a dynamic that oftentimes we overlook on this topic.
Yeah. And I can't read anybody's heart, and neither can you. But there have been times when I have wondered if maybe someone, and I don't have anybody in mind right now, but maybe someone has withheld placing membership to keep from being under the authority of somebody. Now, I don't know that that's ever happened, but my mind, it has crossed my mind. And if that is a motivation, that's a terrible motivation, because we're all to submit one to another. Keith?
To illustrate the point, years ago, there was a young man from Alabama. He was raised as part of a very large church, came to a very small church. When he left us to go back home after finishing his schoolwork, we sent with him a letter of recommendation to the brethren down there. The elders, when they received it, they didn't know what to do with it. We had requested that they themselves read it and then read it to the congregation. They shelved it, and three of the five elders remarked to this young man, "Well, we didn't even know you'd been gone." Now he was gone for three full years. He was so disillusioned with the response of the congregation and the leadership that he fell away from the church, and not too long after that.
Okay, well, that's a sad scenario. And I don't want to know where that occurred, but I can't think it would have occurred any place that I'm very familiar with. So, and to the leaders and to the elders, it's a time to give people a little slack. They need time to find the place and so forth. But I've been involved in a few cases where the people just wouldn't make up their mind. And this is also just when they quit attending. So sometimes we, and I'm sure many of you have, just sent a letter and said, if we don't hear differently from you by such and such a date, we'll no longer be able to consider you part of our congregation. Because it's not appropriate to ask our shepherds to shepherd somebody that they never see. And that's not bad doesn't mean the person who has moved is bad. It's just, to me, a practicality. Anybody else want to make a comment on that before I comment on letters of recommendation, which is kind of a subsegment of this. Okay, I would take us to 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 1 as one of two passages I have found helpful on this. 2 Corinthians chapter 3 and verse 1. And I made an assumption you all know what I mean when I say a letter of recommendation. This is a letter that a person would take from one congregation to another, introducing them, and hopefully their previous congregation can commend them as good Christian workers to this other congregation. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 1, it says, "Do we begin again to commend ourselves? Or need we, as some others, epistles of commendation to you or letters of commendation from you?" The concept there seems to be a letter of introduction, a letter of, this is a good soldier for the Lord, if you will. And having been an elder at two different places, at a couple of different times, that is extremely helpful. And we talked a little bit about this yesterday, about people church hopping, so they get a sinful situation in one congregation, rather than repenting, they go look for another congregation that'll let them come in. Well, if that other congregation doesn't know anything about their background, they might innocently let them in, but switching congregations does not forgive the sin. Only repentance will forgive the sin. And you've probably all seen this occur. So I'm very much an advocate of somebody transferring their membership, having something from their previous congregation to introduce them to the new congregation. Now, it can be a letter. It can be an email. I guess it could even be a text message if you printed it out, but something. I've even occasionally done it with a phone call, but some information so the new congregation knows kind of what's going on. And I can only remember one time when I accepted a couple without a letter of recommendation. They were from quite a ways away and all. We didn't get burnt by it, but as in hindsight, I thought that was a poor decision on my part, and so I've always felt that was a right way to go. Also in Acts chapter 18, verse 27, we have another passage that seems to allude to this. Even if we didn't have passages like this, I think it has some real practical, logical merit. But in Acts chapter 18, verse 27, "And when he was disposed to pass into Achaia, the brethren wrote, exhorting the disciples to receive him, who when he has come helped them much, which had believed through grace." Now this isn't probably, or as I understand it, a transfer of membership, but it is a letter of commendation introducing this man to another group. So I just think that has all kinds of practical, logical ramifications, and I would suspect most, if not all, the congregations represented here try to do that, but I would urge you to do that, especially if you're in an urban area where there are multiple congregations where people can congregation hop without resolving the problem, because then we could have a salvational issue on that for that person. And I think sometimes the leaders of the various congregations need to communicate. And I know several classic examples right here in Des Moines where that has been done, I think, to the betterment of the congregations and people involved. Does anybody want to make a comment or a question on that? Dwayne. I'm sorry.
I'm assuming the situation that you're talking about is where the congregations have fellowship with one another.
Mm-hmm.
What if the person comes from the congregation that there is no fellowship with that particular congregation?
Okay,
Dwayne
is saying, he's assuming I'm talking about congregations that have fellowship and doctrinal harmony one with another. And in general, I was. And his question is, what if it's congregations that maybe don't have that doctrinal sync, and that can take various gradations of doctrinal difference. I still think it's important to at least do our due diligence. Now, there are some congregations, even quote Churches of Christ, that this is a foreign practice to them. And in the one that I mentioned where I didn't seek a letter, they were coming from a congregation, I believe in Texas, but don't quote me on that. And they had just never heard of that practice. They were good, honest, sincere people. Well, I think in a case like that, we can still pick up the phone and call their eldership and ask them the questions that we would feel comfortable with. And I'm not talking about grilling them and having an FBI background check, but I want to know that they were baptized believers. I want some idea that they were in good standing and not have an overt sin hanging over their head, even if this congregation probably had some practices that I wouldn't be comfortable with. Now, when they're coming from a totally different, group, then I think we need to sit down with that person and really make sure that their baptism was the baptism of the New Testament, and it could lead to a rebaptism. But I still think some due diligence. It might not take the form of a letter, because those elders might not be familiar or even willing to do that. I ran into a couple of cases where elders in groups, not in our fellowship, were hesitant to write a letter for they were afraid they might get sued. But you can usually get them to talk to you and at least find out what's going on. Yeah.
But then the letter is not always the best choice, though, because I don't remember where we were at, but there was a divorce that broke the church in half. And elders went on one side, and we went on the other for some reason. They wouldn't have done anything.
Yeah. His comment is there's sometimes when there's been a split, especially over doctrine, or the elders may be on one side and you may be leaving because of that. Well, those elders may not be going to give you a letter. But still, the place you're going can do a little due diligence to find out what the situation is. But yeah, there are ways to work around it and still stay within the spirit of what I'm trying to convey. But that's a valid point. You know, if that's a valid point. Joanne, I'm sorry. Yeah, Joanne's question is, this relates what I'm talking about to believers or Christians. What about non-believers or non-Christians? Well, now we're talking about an issue of converting them to the truth. So if someone comes and we're converting them to the truth, repentance, confession, baptism, there's no need for a letter there because they have not been saved. So to me, this whole conversation does not affect that. Thank you for clearing that up. Because if one person's fuzzy, who knows how many more are fuzzy? Carter? Yes. But I believe it's an example of a person being commended to a congregation so that they can approach them in fellowship, having not previously known them very well. That's the principle that I'm pulling out of that. If you're asking me, is there a verse that says, this is the way you handle membership transfers? No, it doesn't say it quite like that. I'm looking at principles and precedents to help guide us. And if you accept people without a letter, I'm not going to quit coming to your place. I just think it's you're opening yourself up for problems down the road. One more, Janice.
There's an example of a letter in Romans 16:1.
Okay, thank you. She said there's an example of one in Romans 16:1. Okay. And I think at least most of the congregations represented here I'm pseudo-familiar with, and I think that something along this line occurs. Okay, one more real quick one that I was handed by a couple of young men, and it's just so practical that I can't find it. But I remember it. The question was, where do you go to find the qualifications for elders, deacons, and evangelists? Well, just let me give them to you very quickly. The primary ones for elders would be 1 Timothy chapter 3 and Titus chapter 1. And I also like the first four verses of 1 Peter 5. It's more the duties than it is the qualifications. Now, you'll find a few others, but those are the three I would give you. The one for deacon would be 1 Timothy 3. And I told you Monday, I probably am not going to go through those qualifications stepwise, just because I think many of you, or most of you, have been through them to some extent. Evangelist is a little more difficult, because there isn't a place I can turn to you like for elders and deacons. But I would say that the best thing to do, or the best thing I have found, is read the books of 1st, 2nd Timothy and Titus, and see how Paul exhorts those two evangelists to conduct themselves and what kind of character they should have. And you'll find a plethora of requirements. In general, an evangelist needs to have, I think, the same character qualities as an elder, the same abilities. He's not required to be married. He's not required to have children. That would be the primary difference. I think almost all the rest of them I would strongly recommend we look at for our evangelist, including not a novice. Including not a novice. Okay. We've got more questions. We'll deal with them as time permits at the end, but I want to cover some material now. Unless you have another comment. Okay. Jay.
One more thing. Probably the most basic qualification for an evangelist is found in Acts 16.
Which is?
Timothy had a good reputation among the brethren.
Okay. He said, Acts chapter 16, where Timothy had a good reputation amongst the brethren. I would agree that is an important one. We could discuss whether it is the most important one, but in essence, if it's a qualification, they're all equally important. But I can certainly conceive and have seen men with what the congregations thought had a good reputation and turned out to be rather disappointing. But we do the best we can. Okay, he said he thinks we need to differentiate the work of elder and evangelist and fit the qualifications. I don't argue with the differentiation of the work, but to me most of those qualifications are needed for both. In fact, I can't off the top of my head think of one that isn't, other than married and having children. And I personally think that's probably a plus, being someone who stays in a lot of different homes. It at least helps remove.
I can add to that comment, because an evangelist is frequently called in to solve conflicts within a congregation that doesn't help.
Sure. We'll hopefully have a little time to talk about that next week. Who should call them in? But I will simply say, I think a lot of times evangelists do work that elders should be doing. And I don't blame the elders any more than I do the evangelists. There are times, I think, when an evangelist gets a phone call, he ought to say, "You solve that." I don't mean that to be flippant, but I do mean it. Okay. I want to talk a little bit, obviously we're going into Christian leadership, which is where we have been. We're going to be dealing with styles of leadership. I'm not done with the marks or the characteristics of leadership, but I know some of you are going to be leaving, so I didn't want to just give you another characteristic, and those that come in to next week will have a mixture of them both. So I'm going to deal today with styles of leadership. Leadership can be looked at from many different angles: the position, relationships, whoever you have following you, or the actions of leadership. But I think the real distinguishing characteristic of Christian leadership is not position, relationship, or style. It is motivation. Now, having said that, I'm going to spend about the next 15 minutes talking about styles. So I won't say that it is insignificant, but keep in mind as we go through this, I don't think it is the overriding. If you were with me Monday, I mentioned several men: Moses, who was the delegator, Elijah, who was a loner, Peter, who was kind of brash, Paul, who was an organizer. Different styles, but all effective leaders in the Lord's work. Is one a leader because of his position or because of what he does. And by that I mean, are you a leader because somebody appointed you to be an elder? No. Maybe they shouldn't have appointed you to be an elder or a deacon or an evangelist or whatever. Maybe you take a leadership role when you shouldn't. I also want to comment on the concept of manager versus leader. There is a tremendous difference between those two things. And it is sometimes tempting for leaders in the church to be managers and not leaders. And I just called them a leader in the church, and I shouldn't have. Now, there is some element of management to a leadership position in the church, but I think it ought to be a relatively small or a relatively minor part of it. A manager is an administrator or a director. He sees that task gets done, and that is important. But in my personal opinion, that is easy. And it is not leading. It doesn't mean that we don't need it. I always go back to that comment that a person made to me. Being an elder is not that hard. If you can make out the program and make announcements, you can be an elder. He had absolutely no grasp of what the Bible teaches about being a leader in the church. Leaders guide with service. And we've talked some about that. I mentioned the towel and the basin. This comes from John chapter 13, where Jesus washed their feet. He was leading them by example. The purpose of John 13 isn't to make sure the apostles had clean feet. It was to show them how to guide through service. In John chapter 13, verse 14, Jesus says, "I have set an example that you should do as I do." Again, that example is not to have clean feet. That's nice. No, he was guiding us on how to lead. One other passage in the New Testament that talks about Jesus as an example, and this may be the only two that I can recall, is in 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 21, where Jesus says Christ was our example. But that form of leadership is a little bit unnatural. Most people want the title of leader, but would prefer to manage, because managing is easier. You come home at night and you know, well, we made 18 widgets, so we're on schedule. Well, it's important to make 18 widgets, but when a leader comes home, he doesn't always know whether he had a good day or a bad day, and he may not know for quite some time to come. Because he's not dealing in quantifiable things quite that much. I'm going to look at, about five different styles. You can put any kind of names to these, and you could add to these. But as I go through these, I want us to consider which one works best in the church. Charles can tell you or give his thoughts about the family. But as I go through these, and I'm just going to be trying to describe what I mean by these terms, which one works best in the church? The first one I'm going to call autocratic. An autocratic style depends on the authority of the position. Okay, I'm the elder, so that gives me the authority to lead. I get my leadership authority from the fact that somebody made me an elder. I'm not an elder. I'm just role-playing here, okay? An autocratic style tends to cause us to feel indispensable. Well, if I'm not there, it's going to fall apart. And sometimes that's true. It's probably symptomatic of some other problems, but it is quite possible. On a positive, autocratic leadership is extremely effective. You get the jobs done because you don't waste time trying to figure out what's to be done. Somebody tells you what's to be done, and we get about it. I put down an autocratic style tends to protect the flock against false teachers, and then I put a question mark by that. what I initially meant by that is that in an autocratic style, you've got somebody's in charge, and if a false teacher comes in, that person's going to be the one that takes care of that false teacher. And I'll stand by that statement. But why might that style not be good in terms of protecting the flock against false teachers? Pardon? Personal prejudices? Well, I hadn't thought of that one. That autocratic leader could be the false teacher. That's pretty good, Doug. Yeah. And that's kind of in the vein that caused me to put a question mark. If you've got an autocratic style, there's a tendency for us to all rely on him. Well, what if he's not there? Or what if he doesn't see? I'd much rather be in a flock where we've got if we've got 100 members, we've got 100 guards against the false teacher. If Greg and Charles don't happen to be at Vandalia, false teaching is still addressed. So it could be a plus or a minus, but I wasn't comfortable not putting that question mark there because I see both sides of that coin. On a positive side, though, this style is quick acting and decisive. You get right on it. And that does appeal to my type A. And if you're a type A, it will appeal to you. Autocratic leaders, I didn't put this up here, tend to have rather short business meetings, which probably would appeal to some of you too. Bureaucratic, and this kind of sounds similar, but I think there are some differences. This is a rules-oriented style of leadership. Okay, we got our rules, everybody plays by the rules, and we have no problems. Well, and we in the church would say, hopefully, this is our rules. But there are rules other than the Bible. You know, are we going to have basket dinners? Are we going to do this? Are we going to do that? I guess those can become rules. But we would all say the Bible is certainly our doctrinal ruler. And if everybody abides by the rules that we've all agreed on, then we'll live happily ever after. The third one. Is that the way you spell permissive? That just doesn't look right to me. Well, the third one is permissive. And I think that's a little self-explanatory, but it's not necessarily automatically bad. This is the approach that let's keep everybody happy. And the thought is, if people feel good, they'll feel better about working. Well, I think that probably is a true statement. Happy people work. But it can lose or lack some coordination because it is, by definition, permissive. The fourth one I put in here I call hands-off. I call this the Republican approach. The least government is best. Hands off, let people grow and nurture, and don't stifle them with an autocratic approach. It lets the organization run its natural course. Oh, you probably weren't done, but maybe you didn't want it. As I go through these, there are things that appeal to me about all of these. And there are things I don't like about all of these. We'll go back and discuss what we might or might not like. The last one that I put down, or I call it participatory. And as the name would suggest, everybody participates in the decision-making and in the work as much as possible. And this would kind of go hand-in-hand with my comments on delegating, getting people involved. I like that. It motivates vis-a-vis letting people participate not only in the work, but in the decision-making. And that would appeal to many of you. It generates a feeling of shared ownership in the task. Not ownership in the church, but ownership in the task. That's good too, I think. It can be a little slow, because the more people you have involved in decision-making and tasks, you don't make them as quick. This would not be a good leadership style for the military. Probably wouldn't work. Well, are we going to shoot? Well, let's vote. Well, by that time, all us shooters are dead. So now we come down to which style is best for the church. We've got autocratic, bureaucratic, permissive, hands-off Republican, and participatory. Now it's your turn.
Are we
going to
vote on those?
Hey, notice permissive is spelled right.
Yeah.
It wasn't? Oh. Okay. Which one of those works best in the church? Okay, I've had a couple of combinations. Okay, Jay says, isn't this a good argument for multiple elders, a plurality of elders? That sounds right. Mike?
Which of these, if any of them, is Christ's style of leadership? And if you can answer that question, that might guide us as to the way we...
Mike says, which one of these were Christ's style, and that should be a guide. Now Mike is going to answer that. Do you have a thought on that?
Well, I'm thinking that perhaps as divine, none of them were Christ's style.
Okay. That's a very decisive answer. But it might be the right answer. It might be the right answer. Which one of those, or do any of those, strike you as Christ's style? The last one? Participatory? Okay. I'm not setting you up. I'm just trying to let us think through our lunch a little bit here. Gregory? Okay. Pretty autocratic. Okay. Which one's that? Okay. She said, go and sin no more. That's what Jesus said. So she said, it kind of depends on the situation. Okay, whether you've got the right answer or not, I don't know, but you've got my answer, so I feel good about that. I would say which one of these was Christ would depend upon the situation. I think he used many of these. I won't know if he used all of these. But there were times when I think Christ was very autocratic. This is it. That's the end of it. There were probably times when he, through delegation, allowed people to participate, and we talked about this in delegation, in a way that was less effective than if he had just done it himself. But again, remember, the task isn't always the job, it's the growth and the development and the relationships of the people that are working that is the job. And I think he did that. I'm not sure I'm comfortable sticking permissive on him, although there probably could be an angle that we could come up with. My best answer to which one of these is best for the church is, I think they all have their place, and it depends upon the situation that we're dealing with, and it depends upon the people that we are dealing with. I'm not speaking about leaders who are inconsistent and treat one person with the bar lower than another person. I'm talking about individuals who need to be handled differently. If you're a parent and have more than one child, you understand this concept. One child, you could beat them with a 2x6, and the smile would never leave their face. The other one, you would forget to kiss goodnight, and they would cry for a week. Guess which one I was. Guess which one you were. But they're different. Well, so are sheep. So are we in the flock. Some of you are very, very sensitive. Some of you... don't have that same level of sensitivity and might need to be dealt with a little bit differently. In times of crisis, and congregations have crisis, that's when I would probably shift into an autocratic mode. Somebody's got to take charge and lead. And when we've got a crisis, let's don't necessarily have 14 ballots. if we don't need it. But in times of peace, a participatory approach, I think, has some real benefits. It gets more people involved. There's a passage in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 that just occurred to me this morning sometime, and I wrote it down that I had never quite looked at it in this sense, but I think it may have some bearing. In 1 Corinthians chapter 9, verses 21 and 22, Paul says, "To them that are without law, as without law, not being without law to God, but under the law of Christ, that I might gain them that are without the law. To the weak, because I am weak, that I might gain the weak. I am made all things to all men." Now, I'm not going to present that that was his predominant thought when he wrote that, but being all things to all men, to me, conjures up some flexibility in his approach to various people. And I think that has a place in the church. It has a place in the home. Not different doctrinal standards. Sin is still sin. That's not what I'm saying. But the approach at which we do it. I think that's probably one of the reasons we don't have in the Bible a complete A, B, C, D, E, F, G on how to handle every discipline problem. We're not told how long, how patient, how quick. Because each case has some differentiation to it. There's an old Indian proverb, "Nothing grows under a banyan tree." And a banyan tree, if I understand it, is this huge tree that spreads out and it's total shade under it, and nothing can grow. Well, if you're a banyan tree leader and you suffocate your congregation, it won't grow. I was working with a congregation for an extended period of time that had lost their leadership and now have it back. And several of the members said, "For years we were not allowed to breathe." And I think they might have been right. Well, what happened is, once they gasped for air, they gasped outside the boundaries of what was right, and it's called an explosion. And we don't want that in any congregation. That's not biblical leadership. Great leaders customize their leadership style rather than assuming one style fits all people for all occasions. And please, I'm not talking about favoritism or inconsistency. I'm talking about understanding the differences in the people that we guide. Now, that's common sense, but it gets lost sometimes. And I totally agree with Jay's comment. This is probably one of the reasons God's wisdom urges us to have a plurality of leaders, so that we have the difference. If you have a plurality of elders in your home congregation, I can guarantee you, you're more comfortable talking to one than you are the others. And others feel differently, but they have someone there that's just natural. Just like you're more comfortable talking to mom or dad, whichever the case may be. Some of you talk to dad, some of you talk to mom. And some of you maybe don't talk, but you're probably more comfortable with one than the other. Does anybody have a comment on that you would like to make? And please feel free to bring a different perspective to it if you would care to. In business, they tell you, this is the style that will work. I'll get it. In church, I think we have to be a lot more discerning than that. Marvin? He said he feels the one we would go to is the one we have confidence in understanding the situation. Absolutely. This isn't in my notes, but they teach you this in some sales courses. This is an awfully good reason for leaders in a congregation to periodically be in the homes of their members. And let me tell you why. When you walk into somebody's home, if you're alert and not asleep at the switch, you will immediately start looking about what's in the house, what's on the walls, and that will tell you a plethora about that person. And it will instantly, if you train yourself a little bit, teach you almost instantly some of the ways in which you can get this person to respond. When I go into somebody's home, and I've been into a lot of people's homes, I don't nose around, but I just observe, because I was taught when it was in sales, you go into a person's office, you can find his hot buttons without ever talking to him. Just look. Does he have Little League pictures on the wall? Or does he have fishing pictures on the wall? Does he have hunting pictures on the wall? Or does he have NASCAR pictures? And I can talk about all of your flock is all about so much differently in that setting than you do simply in the assembly. Now, we need to have time together in the assembly, but if you haven't had your leaders of your congregation in your home, invite them over. And if you're a leader and haven't been in somebody's home, go. I've been in congregations where I've been holding a meeting and I'm invited to somewhere for supper, and these people have been meeting together for 25 years and they can't tell me how to get to the other person's house. Well, do you have to know how to get to someone's house to be saved? No, but it causes me to wonder about how well they know each other. Anybody want to make a comment before I move to an application? I'm not sure. I'm just going to do this one, and then I may come back and do some more. I thought of Nathan. Nathan the prophet, he's not in the Bible a lot, but we know him primarily because of 2 Samuel chapter 12, where he comes and gives David the parable of the sheep, and David says, he says, "You are the man," and he nails him. But a little bit before that, in chapter 7, Nathan comes into the scene. And there's a discussion here about the building of the temple. And in verse 2, the king said unto Nathan the prophet, "See now, I dwell in the house of cedar, but the ark of the Lord dwelleth in curtains." And Nathan said to the king, Go, do all that is in your heart, for the Lord is with you. David is saying, you know, should I go build a temple or a house for the Lord? And Nathan says, go do it. Then we get to verse 4, and the Lord comes on the scene and says, "Nathan, that's the wrong answer." Now, this is a paraphrase for the sake of time. That's a wrong answer. And you know what Nathan goes back and tells David. No, you don't build it. Your descendants, and we know that was to be Solomon, is going to build it. Now, in verse 3, Nathan gives him the answer that is politically correct. King, you go do whatever. In verse 4 and following, God contradicts Nathan's, and Nathan changes. He reminds David of his humble beginnings, beginning with verse 8, for the next several verses. And that's the way Nathan approaches David on that issue. Now, when we get to chapter 12, and I'm not going to read this because I think many of you are familiar, and if not, you can go back and read it at your leisure. We have God sending Nathan to address David regarding his sin with Bathsheba and the killing of Uriah. And he uses what I would call a surgically precise parable. I mean, he just nails him. And I don't know if you enjoy seeing people get nailed, but it's kind of interesting to watch it happen. I guess I'm showing that sometimes I do enjoy it. It's just some people can do that so well. And he just nails him. And he gets him right there, and David's saying, "Yeah, that guy's a jerk." And then he says, "Okay, David, you're the jerk." And that's the old King James translation. But notice what Nathan used. He used a parable about sheep. Why do you think Nathan used a parable of sheep instead of a parable about donkeys? Because David could relate to sheep. He used one that I think it doesn't say the Lord told David or Nathan to use this parable. He may have, but he doesn't say that. He just tells Nathan to go do it. And I just find it interesting that he uses this surgically precise parable, and he uses elements in that parable that would mean so much. I mean, if someone came and gave me a sheep parable, that wouldn't mean a whole lot to me. I mean, I might learn from it, but I've never done anything with sheep other than look at them. Point is, he used a different approach in chapter 12 than he did in chapter 7. Now, in this case, he was talking to the same man, but the circumstances had changed, hadn't they? And what worked in chapter 7 maybe wouldn't have been what would have worked in chapter 12, so he changes his approach. I think there's a leadership lesson there for us. Could it be that what works best for one person might not be the best for another person? Well, I hope by this point that's a rhetorical question. Could what works best for one congregation not be what's best for another congregation? I'm going to insert this. Could it be that someone who is an effective leader at one congregation would not be an effective leader at another congregation? Absolutely so. And I'm not talking about compromising of the qualifications. I'm just talking about chemistries and personalities. Just a couple of things to consider when leading before I close out this particular segment. I believe it's important for us to consider the context. What do I mean by that? I'm talking about the context of the person we're dealing with. Now remember, this is just not elders and members. We are all to be leaders. In Galatians chapter 6, verse 1, ye which are spiritual, restore such a one in the spirit of meekness. Go and lead that person back. So don't sit there saying, okay, I hope my elders are listening. Well, I hope they are too, if it's worthwhile, but I hope we're listening. Consider the context of that person. What's going on in their lives? That is a very, very important to consider in order to know what might work best in reaching that person. What's going to motivate them? Well, this will differ with personalities, and it will also differ with the context of their lives. If a person is single and doesn't have any children, don't go and tell him he needs to do this for the sake of his children. Now, that's obviously a facetious, silly one, but we probably do things not too much more ill thought out. Form of communication. What I mean by that is different people respond to different forms of communication. If I've got a problem with Marvin Ingle, and I send him an email, it might be a while before I hear from Marvin. Now, he used to have email. I don't know if he still does, but not everybody responds to that. If I'm trying to talk to some of the young people, I would use email or text. But if it's an older person that I know has no interest in cell phones, has no interest in internet, I got to use the phone or write them a letter. But a young person probably would respond to a text quicker than they would any of those things. By the way, I've learned how to text. Praise the Lord. I was texting the other day, and then at the funeral, Sam Woody, who's going to be here Sunday, I think, he overheard me mention to Shane, my youngest, that I had texted. Sam went, wow, in a facetious way. But he thought I had moved. But I have learned how to do it. And I may have to, because it kind of works. But different people respond in different ways. So consider that. That's my point. Lead in the way that is best for them, not in the way that is most comfortable for you. And I'm going to repeat that so that I hear it. We tend to lead in ways that are most comfortable for us. I'm going to challenge us to not simply lead in the ways that are most comfortable and convenient for us, but we lead in the ways that will be best and most effective for the people we're trying to reach. And that probably is a pretty important comment regarding evangelizing people. It seems to me in the New Testament they met people where they were, rather than trying to get the people to come where they were. In the Bible studies I have done, I've been far more effective in the person's home of whom I'm studying with than in my home, because they are comfortable there. You're going to convert more people around a kitchen table than you will from a pulpit. It's fine to invite them to church, just don't expect that to convert them. It might occasionally, but very seldom. Is it easier just to have them to come to church? Sure, because I'm going to be there anyway. That's not where they're at. Lead in a way that is best for them and not in a way that is most comfortable for us. I'm going to pause there now and see if anybody has any questions on this concept of leadership styles and leading. I've got another segment of this, but I'm going to save that till probably Monday. Lynette. And words don't mean the same thing to everybody. I won't mention who it was, but it just kind of struck me this week. I used a term that meant totally different things to the people standing in the group I was talking to. I used the term shooting up. And one person took that to mean grow. Another person took it to be mainlining heroin. I'm not going to tell you which way I was using it. It's irrelevant, but it's important to know who you're talking to in your choice of words and in your lingo. And that may mean, and back to plurality of elders, some elders can talk that language. I can't talk farming. I mean, I can say the word, but I don't know anything about that. But if you want to talk sports, I'll be here till next Friday. So, that is important. Very good. Thank you. Anybody else have a comment or a question you would like to make on this, or what you've seen that maybe could help us all? Where are we at here? Donna. Of a member? I'm going to repeat that because I doubt you heard it. She said, I made the comment about it. One, it's a good thing, I think, for elders to go, if they can, to be in their members' homes. You know, not to be a pest, but just to get to know. She said, have I ever been in a situation where you would go to a member's door and they would come out and meet you on the porch and not let you in the house? Is that the gist of it? No, I haven't personally, but I can sure believe that has happened. I can sure believe that has happened. And if that does happen, we need to respect the privacy of whatever that's motivating them. If we force our way in, we're going to do more harm than damage, but it certainly to me is a signal that there needs to be work done in some way in that person's head or others. And you know, it could happen occasionally just because their house is a mess. And maybe it's better to call in advance, but that's probably polite. I just wish we lived back when you didn't have to call in advance. You could just pop in on people. Charles?
Well, I know a situation like that.
And where they wouldn't let you in?
Well, yeah.
Well, yeah.
It so happens they wouldn't let you in either. The wife is a hoarder, and the house, basically you move through little trails in the house. She doesn't want anybody to know that, and he doesn't want to embarrass her, and consequently, you show up unannounced. And
yeah.
Yeah.
And that's a valid point, and if that happens, have that conversation where they're willing to have it. Otherwise, we'll do more harm than good. But have I personally had that happen? No. I may have gone into a house or two that I would have rather stayed on the porch, but that's been very rare too, and I've been very blessed with all the hospitality people show me. And it has nothing to do with size or anything like that. It's just, was that Milford?
Going back to college, people going to college.
Yes.
The best way to eliminate a problem is to take care of the shortcoming problem. If you've got a job, a kid is going to go away to college, good time for the elders to meet with them before long before they're going to college.
Yeah. Yeah. He's going back to our comment about military and the college, and you just say, you know, address that before it becomes a problem. And many of you young people have done that, and I applaud you, and I'm not castigating you if it didn't work out that way. We've got a young man over here that went to Chicago to college, and I won't say it was a big difficulty, but getting to church was more than walking across the street for Sean, and he did it. And I know he did it for two reasons. Number one, he told me he did it, and people from that congregation are here, and they know who he is. And, you know, so I applaud him, and I could applaud others. I just happened to be thinking of Sean. But, you know, that you don't have to go to where you can't worship with a faithful congregation in order to get the education you want. That's the bottom line. And I don't know that, well, that's period. There's a period there. So it's just something, and we parents can help. And then, as Milford said, maybe the elders can help. I've had several people ask me this week, do you know of a congregation in this area? Because they're just thinking of traveling. And I really like it when people think that way. Plan our travel so that we don't forsake the assembly. And that's probably a little different topic, but it's one I feel more strongly about now than I did 30 years ago, put it that way. Anybody else have a comment or a question you would like to make on this subject? Carter?
I'll say a little bit on the plurality of elders. I'm not sure. Even number or an odd.
Okay, we touched just a little bit on his comment on the plurality of elders. What about an even or odd number? We touched a little bit about this the other day, just in passing. I think any time we can have a plurality, well, if you don't have elders and you appoint them, I believe you have to appoint a multiple elders. There are times when one dies and then we have to figure out what's best. But I think in an ideal situation, an odd number is always best just so you don't have ties. But I do not think an even number is unscriptural. It may just take a little bit more teamwork within that eldership to work because you could have a one-on-one or a two-on-two tie. But I think that odd has some practical pluses. But if you're a congregation that doesn't have elders and you have two men qualified, I would not wait until you have a third. I'd go ahead and get those elders in, because even a medium eldership is better than a good oversight, in my opinion. And I don't think oversight is unscriptural. I just don't think that's God's intent in the long run. Just a minute. I had Albert. Maybe you were first, but I didn't see you. Albert?
Along with communication, one of the most valuable free commodities we have is time.
Okay. And Ed's going to talk to us Sunday afternoon about how the senior citizens and all they can do. And it's not just you folks, but in theory, you got time you didn't used to have when you were raising your family. Now the question is, what are you going to do with it? But for all of us, the question is, what are we going to do with time? So, Jay.
Assuming all the men are qualified as elders, the more elders the church has, the better off they are.
Jay's comment is, assuming they're qualified, the more the better. And I think I would agree with that. And in that context, we sometimes fall into the trap, I think it's a trap, of thinking we have enough officers and we don't need to consider more officers until somebody dies. If I look that up under Lee's dictionary, it's under the heading of stupid. For a couple of reasons. If they're qualified, let more people pull the wagon. And what a better time for these other men to be learning than under the tutelage of someone who's maybe had some experience. Now they have to be qualified. I would love to go to a congregation where every adult male was an officer. I've never been to one, and maybe that's just can't hardly happen, but I think that'd be one. That's the ideal. That's the ideal. I was working with a group not long ago, and I'm not even going to give you numbers because that might cause somebody to figure out who it is, but the kind of was, well, at our size, do we need more? Well, that's irrelevant. At your size, do you have more? That's the question. Excellent comment. Excellent. Anybody else care to make a comment? Okay. Well, we could start doing questions, but let me see. I want to see anybody's hand that would be upset if I let you out 3 minutes early. Okay, everybody but Steve Raddick is dismissed. Go ahead and take your break. I don't want to start something new.